An excerpt from Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, Chapter 16, Lateral Thinking, by Eliezer Yudkowsky, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Let me zoom in here. That's 2:35 p.m., when most of the seats were taken and no one else seemed to be coming in. Professor Quirrell gave a sudden jerk in his chair and sat up straight, and his face appeared on all the flat, white rectangular objects that were propped up on the students' desks. Harry was taken by surprise, both by the sudden appearance of Professor Quirrell's face and by the resemblance to Muggle television. There was something both nostalgic and sad about that. It seemed so much like a piece of home, and yet it wasn't, really. "Good afternoon, my young apprentices," said Professor Quirrell. His voice seemed to come from the desk screen, and to be speaking directly to Harry. "Welcome to your first lesson in battle magic, as the founders of Hogwarts would have put it, or, as it happens to be called in the late 20th century, defense against the dark arts." There was a certain amount of frantic scrabbling as students, taken by surprise, reached for their parchment or notebooks. "Now," Professor Quirrell said, "don't bother writing down what this subject was once called. No such pointless question will count toward your marks in any of my lessons. That is a promise." Many students sat straight up at that, looking rather shocked. Professor Quirrell was smiling thinly. "Those of you who have wasted time by reading your useless first-year defense textbooks," someone made a choking sound, Harry wondered if it was Hermione, "may have gotten the impression that although this subject is called Defense Against the Dark Arts, it is actually about how to defend against nightmare butterflies, which can cause mildly bad dreams, or acid slugs, which can dissolve all the way through a 2-inch wooden beam given most of a day." Professor Quirrell stood up, shoving his chair back from the desk. The screen on Harry's desk followed his every move. Professor Quirrell strode towards the front of the classroom and bellowed, "The Hungarian horntail is taller than a dozen men. It breathes fire so quickly and so accurately that it can melt a snitch in mid-flight. One killing curse will bring it down." There were gasps from the students. "The mountain troll is more dangerous than the Hungarian horntail. It is strong enough to bite through steel. Its hide is resistant enough to withstand stunning hexes and cutting charms. Its sense of smell is so acute that it can tell from afar whether its prey is part of a pack or alone and vulnerable. Most fearsome of all, the troll is unique among magical creatures in continuously maintaining a form of transfiguration on itself. It is always transforming into its own body. If you somehow succeed in ripping off its arm, it will grow another within seconds. Fire and acid will produce scar tissue, which can temporarily confuse a troll's regenerative powers for an hour or two. They are smart enough to use clubs as tools. The mountain troll is the third most perfect killing machine in all nature. One killing curse will bring it down." The students were looking rather shocked. Professor Quirrell was smiling rather grimly. "Your sad excuse for a third-year defense textbook will suggest to you that you expose the mountain troll to daylight, which will freeze it in place. This, my young apprentices, is the sort of useless knowledge you will never find in my lessons. You do not encounter mountain trolls in open daylight. The idea that you should use sunlight to stop them is the result of foolish textbook authors trying to show off their mastery of minutiae at the expense of practicality. Just because there is a ridiculously obscure way of dealing with mountain trolls does not mean you should actually try to use it. The killing curse is unblockable, unstoppable, and works every single time on anything with a brain. If, as an adult wizard, you find yourself incapable of using the killing curse, then you can simply apparate away. Likewise, if you are facing the second most perfect killing machine, a Dementor, you just apparate away." "Unless, of course," Professor Quirrell said, his voice now lower and harder, "you are under the influence of an anti-apparition jinx. There is exactly one monster which can threaten you once you're fully grown. The single most dangerous monster in all the world. So dangerous that nothing else comes close. The Dark Wizard. That is the only thing that will still be able to threaten you." Professor Quirrell's lips were set in a thin line. "I will reluctantly teach you enough trivia for a passing mark on the ministry-mandated portions of your first-year finals. Since your exact mark on these sections will make no difference to your future life, anyone who wants more than a passing mark is welcome to waste their own time studying our pathetic excuse for a textbook. The title of this subject is not Defense Against Minor Pests. You're here to learn how to defend yourself against the dark arts, which means, let us be very clear on this, defending yourselves against dark wizards. people with wands who want to hurt you, and who will likely succeed in doing so unless you hurt them first. There is no defense without offense. There is no defense without fighting. This reality is deemed too harsh for 11-year-olds by the fat, overpaid, or guarded politicians who mandated your curriculum. To the abyss with those fools! You are here for the subject that has been taught at Hogwarts for 800 years. Welcome to your first year of battle magic! Harry started applauding. He couldn't help himself. It was too inspiring. Once Harry started clapping, there was some scattered response from Gryffindor, and more from Slytherin, but most students simply seemed too stunned to react. Professor Quirrell made a cutting gesture, and the applause died instantly. "Thank you very much," said Professor Quirrell. "Now to practicalities. I have combined all my first-year battle classes into one, which allows me to offer you twice as much classroom time as double sessions," there were gasps of horror, "an increased load which I will make up to you by not assigning any homework." The gasps of horror cut off abruptly. "Yes, you heard me correctly. I will teach you to fight, not to write 12 inches on fighting due Monday." Harry desperately wished he'd sat next to Hermione so he could see the look on her face now, but on the other hand, he was pretty sure he was imagining it accurately. Also, Harry was in love. It would be a 3-way wedding. Him, the Time Turner, and Professor Quirrell. "For those of you who so choose, I have arranged some after-school activities that I think you will find quite interesting as well as educational. Do you want to show the world your own abilities instead of watching 14 other people play Quidditch? More than 7 people can fight in an army. Hot damn. These and other after-school activities will also earn you Quirrell points." "What are Quirrell points, you ask?" "The house point system does not suit my needs because it makes house points too rare. I prefer to let my students know how they are doing more frequently than that. And on the rare occasions I offer you a written test, it will mark itself as you go along. And if you get too many related questions wrong, your test will show the names of students who got those questions right, and those students will be able to earn Quirrell points by helping you." Wow. Why didn't the other professors use a system like that? "What good are Quirrell points, you wonder? For a start, 10 Quirrell points will be worth 1 house point, but they will earn you other favors as well. Would you like to take your exam at an unusual time? Is there a particular session you would very much prefer to skip? You will find that I can be very flexible on behalf of students who have accumulated enough Quirrell points. Quirrell points will control generalship of the armies. And for Christmas, just before the Christmas break, I will grant someone a wish. Any school-related feat that lies within my power, my influence, or above all, my ingenuity. Yes, I was in Slytherin, and I am offering to formulate a cunning plot on your behalf, if that is what it takes to accomplish your desire. This wish will go to whoever has earned the most Quirrell points within all 7 years. That would be Harry. Now leave your books and loose items at your desks. They will be safe. The screens will watch over them for you. And come down onto this platform. It's time to play a game called Who's the Most Dangerous Student in the Classroom?
In answer to your question, I don't really know. It's initially based on my thought on the treadmill today was, what if Snape but fast? And I don't mean my Snape, I mean movie Snape. What if Snape but higher and faster? But I'm putting more of a flourish on that. I'm putting more of a posh flourish on it. It's like,
now leave your books and loose items at your desks. They'll be safe. The screens will watch over them for you and come down onto this platform. It's time to play a game called Who's the Most Dangerous Student in the Classroom?
You see? It's that, but faster and higher. Yeah, it's definitely influenced by both that Monty Python sketch where John Cleese is going, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0! That one, and also the dude that yells at what's his name in A Clockwork Orange? You know, stay behind the line at all times. You know what whatever the fuck that is. But yeah, yeah. He stopped because he's impatient. All of this, he just wants to get through it. You know, it's like he's like this close to snapping in frustration at how slow things go at any given fucking moment. I think This next one, the next part of this chapter doesn't really stand so well on its own. Oh, you know, I would really like to. I hate. One thing I unironically hate about this fic is how obtusely named the fucking chapters are. Like, oh, because what I'm trying to farm right now is the Harry's first conversation with Dumbledore. And I got no fucking clue where that is. Because I want to try my Dumbledore on with this Dumbledore, because this is the best Dumbledore has ever been. Okay, here we go. Found it.
"Please don't hurry too much, Mr. Potter," squeaked Professor Flitwick from somewhere around Harry's shoulder level. Harry was grateful for Professor Flitwick's gigantic puffy beard. It was hard getting used to a professor who was not only shorter than him, but spoke in a higher-pitched voice. "Headmaster Dumbledore may seem a little odd, or a lot odd, or even extremely odd, but he has never hurt a student in the slightest, and I don't believe he ever will." Professor Flitwick gave Harry an encouraging smile. Just keep that in mind at all times, and you'll be sure not to panic." This was not helping. "Good luck," squeaked Professor Flitwick, and leaned over to the gargoyle and said something that Harry somehow failed to hear at all. Of course, the password wouldn't be much good if you could hear someone saying it. And the stone gargoyle walked aside with a very natural and ordinary movement that Harry found rather shocking, since the gargoyle still looked like solid, immovable stone the whole time. Behind the gargoyle was a set of slowly revolving spiral stairs. There was something disturbingly hypnotic about it, and even more disturbing was that revolving the spiral ought not to take you anywhere.
"Up you go!" squeaked Flitwick.
Harry rather nervously stepped into the spiral and found himself, for some reason that his brain couldn't seem to visualize at all, moving upwards. The gargoyle thudded back into place behind him, and the spiral stairs kept turning, and Harry kept being higher up, and after a rather dizzying time, Harry found himself in front of an oak door with a brass griffin knocker. Harry reached out and turned the doorknob. The door swung open. And Harry saw the most interesting room he'd ever seen in his life. There were tiny metal mechanisms that whirred or ticked or slowly changed shape. Emitted little puffs of smoke. There were dozens of mysterious fluids in dozens of oddly shaped containers, all bubbling, boiling, oozing, changing color, or forming into interesting shapes that vanished half a second after you saw them. There were things that looked like clocks with many hands, inscribed with numbers or in unrecognizable languages. There was a bracelet bearing a lenticular crystal that sparkled with a thousand colors, and a bird perched atop a golden platform, and a wooden cup filled with what looked like blood, and a statue of a falcon encrusted in black enamel. The wall was all hung with pictures of people sleeping, and the sorting hat was casually poised on a hat rack that was also holding two umbrellas and three red slippers for left feet.
Damn it.
In the midst of all the chaos was a clean, black oaken desk. Before the desk was an oaken stool, and behind the desk was a well-cushioned throne containing Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who was adorned with a long silver beard, a hat like a squashed giant mushroom, and what looked to Muggle eyes like three layers of bright pink pajamas.
Yeah, I'll do some amakis after this. Damn it. Okay.
Dumbledore was smiling, and his bright eyes twinkled with a mad intensity. With some trepidation, Harry seated himself in front of the desk. The door swung shut behind him with a loud thunk. "Hello, Harry," said Dumbledore. "Hello, Headmaster," Harry replied.
Would Dumbledore now say to call him?
"Please, Harry," said Dumbledore. "Headmaster sounds so formal. Just call me He for short."
"I'll be sure to, He," said Harry.
There was a slight pause.
"Do you know," said Dumbledore, "you're the first person who's ever taken me up on that."
"Ah," Harry said. He tried to control his voice despite the sudden sinking feeling in his stomach.
"I'm sorry, Headmaster, you told me to do it, so I did."
Heh, please, said Dumbledore cheerfully.
And there's no call to be so worried. I won't launch you out a window just because you made one mistake. I'll give you plenty of warnings first if you're doing something wrong. Besides, what matters isn't how people talk to you. It's what they think of you."
This is... Dumbledore is flowing.
He's never hurt a student. Just keep remembering that and you'll be sure not to panic.
Dumbledore drew forth a small metal case and flipped it open. Showing some small yellow lumps.
"Sherbet lemon," said the headmaster.
No thank you, Heh, said Harry.
"Does slipping a student LSD count as hurting them, or does that fall into the category of harmless fun?"
"You, said something about my being too young to invoke the words of power and madness?"
"That you most certainly are," Dumbledore said. Thankfully, the words of power and madness were lost 7 centuries ago, and no one has the slightest idea what they are anymore. It was just a little remark.
"Ah," Harry said. He was aware that his mouth was hanging open.
"Why did you call me here, then?"
"Why? Why?" Dumbledore repeated. "Ah, Harry, if I went around all day asking why I do things, I'd never have time to get a single thing done. I'm quite a busy person, you know."
Harry nodded, smiling.
"Yes, it was a very impressive list. Headmaster of Hogwarts, Chief Warlock of the Wizengamot, and Supreme Mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards. Sorry to ask, but I was wondering, is it possible to get more than 6 hours if you use more than one time timer? Because it's pretty impressive if you're doing all that on just 30 hours a day."
There was another slight pause, during which Harry went on smiling. He was a little apprehensive, actually a lot apprehensive,
But once it had become clear that Dumbledore was deliberately messing with him, something within him absolutely refused to sit and take it like a defenseless lump. "I'm afraid time doesn't like being stretched out too much," said Dumbledore after the slight pause. And yet we ourselves seem to be a little too large for it. And so it's a constant struggle to fit our lives into time. "Indeed," Harry said with grave solemnity. "That's why it's best to come to our points quickly." For a moment, Harry wondered if he'd gone too far. Then Dumbledore chuckled. "Straight to the point it shall be." The headmaster leaned forwards, tilting his squashed mushroom hat and brushing his beard against the desk. "Harry, this morning you did something that should have been impossible even with a time-turner. Or rather, impossible with only a time-turner. Where did those two pies come from, I wonder?" A jolt of adrenaline shot through Harry. He'd done that using the cloak of invisibility, the one that had been given him in a Christmas box, along with a note, and that note had said, "If Dumbledore saw a chance to possess one of the Deathly Hallows, he would never let it escape his grasp." "A natural thought," Dumbledore went on, "is that since none of the first years present were able to cast such a spell, someone else was present and yet unseen. And if no one could see them, why, it would be easy enough for them to throw the pies. One might further suspect that since you had a time-turner, you were the invisible one, and that since the spell of disillusionment is far beyond your current abilities, you had an invisibility cloak." Dumbledore smiled conspiratorially. Am I on the right track so far, Harry?" Harry was frozen. He had the feeling that an outright lie would not be. He had a feeling that an outright lie would not at all be wise, and possibly not the least bit helpful, and he couldn't think of anything else to say. Dumbledore waved a friendly hand. "Don't worry, Harry. You haven't done anything wrong. Invisibility cloaks aren't against the rules. I suppose they're rare enough that no one ever got around to putting them on the list. But really, I was wondering something else entirely." "Oh?" Harry said in the most normal voice he could manage. Dumbledore's eyes shone with enthusiasm. "You see, Harry, after you've been through a few adventures, you tend to catch the hang of these things. You start to see the pattern, hear the rhythm of the world. You begin to harbor suspicions before the moment of revelation. You are the boy who lived, and somehow an invisibility cloak made its way into your hands only 4 days after you discovered our magical Britain. Such cloaks are not for sale in Diagon Alley, but there is one which might find its own way to a destined wearer. And so I cannot help but wonder if by some strange chance you have found not just an invisibility cloak, but the cloak of invisibility, one of the three Deathly Hallows, and reputed to hide the wearer from the gaze of death himself." Dumbledore's gaze was bright and eager. "May I see it, Harry?" Harry swallowed. There was a full flood of adrenaline in his system now, and it was entirely useless. This was the most powerful wizard in the world, and there was no way he could make it out the door, and there was nowhere in Hogwarts for him to hide if he did. He was about to lose the cloak that had been passed down through the Potters for who knew how long. Slowly, Dumbledore leaned back into his high chair. The bright light had gone out of his eyes, and he looked puzzled and a little sorrowful. Harry, Harry, said Dumbledore, if you don't want to, you can just say no. You can just say no.
I can? I can?
Harry croaked. Yes, Harry, said Dumbledore. His voice sounded sad now and worried. It seems that you're afraid of me, Harry. May I ask what I've done to earn your distrust? May I ask what I've done to earn your distrust? Harry swallowed. Is there some way you can swear a binding magical oath that you won't take my cloak? Dumbledore shook his head slowly. Unbreakable vows are not to be used so lightly. And besides, Harry, if you did not already know the spell, you would only have my word that the spell was binding. Yet surely you realize that I do not need your permission to see the cloak. I am powerful enough to draw it forth myself. Moleskin powder, no. Dumbledore's face was very grave. But this I will not do. The cloak is yours, Harry. I will not steal it from you. I will not seize it from you. Not even to look at for just a moment, unless you decide to show it to me. That is a promise and an oath. Should I need to prohibit you from using it on the school grounds, I will require you to go to your vault at Gringotts and store it there.
Ah,
Harry said. He swallowed hard, trying to calm the flood of adrenaline and think reasonably. He took the moleskin pouch off his belt. If you really don't need my permission, then you have it. Harry held out the pouch to Dumbledore and bit down hard on his lip, sending that signal to himself in case he was obliviated afterwards. The old wizard reached into the pouch, and without saying any word of retrieval, drew forth the cloak of invisibility. Ah, breathed Dumbledore. I was right. He poured the shimmering black velvet mesh through his hand. Centuries old, and still as perfect as the day it was made. We have lost much of our art over the years. And now I cannot make such a thing myself. No one can. I feel the power of it like an echo in my mind. Like a song forever being sung without anyone to hear it. The wizard looked up from the cloak. Do not sell it, he said. Do not give it to anyone as a possession. Think twice before you show it to anyone, and ponder three times again before you reveal it as a deathly hallow. Treat it with respect, for this is indeed a thing of power. For a moment, Dumbledore's face grew wistful, and then he handed the cloak back to Harry. Harry put it back in his pouch.
That, I think, will be all of that that I do.
Welcome to the real world. For the longest time, I wouldn't believe it, But then I saw the fields with my own eyes, watched them liquefy the dead so they could be fed intravenously to the living. Excuse me, please.
It's a terrible Keanu.
Yes, Neo. I've kept quiet for as long as I could, but I feel a certain need to speak up at this point. The human body is the most inefficient source of energy you could possibly imagine. The efficiency of a power plant at converting thermal energy into electricity decreases as you run the turbines at lower temperatures. If you had any sort of food humans could eat, it would be more efficient to burn it in a furnace than feed it to humans. And now you're telling me that their food is the bodies of the dead fed to the living? Haven't you ever heard of the laws of thermodynamics? Where did you hear about the laws of thermodynamics, Neo? Anyone who's made it past one science class in high school ought to know about the laws of thermodynamics. Where did you go to high school, Neo? In the Matrix. The machines tell elegant lies. Could I please have a real physics textbook? There is no such thing, Neo. The universe doesn't run on math.
That's one of the best fucking things. Do I have any Amake requests from the Elfangors in the audience? My favorites are that one and, like, I mean, all of these are good, but, like, the My Little Pony one is great. The Lord of the Rings one is just, like, legit good. Like, it's not, like, funny or anything. It's just good. The new House one? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's earlier. Let me,
Oh dear, this has never happened before. What? I'm allergic to your hair shampoo.
And then the Sorting Hat sneezed, with a mighty achoo that echoed around the great hall. Well, Dumbledore cried jovially, it seems Harry Potter has been sorted into the new House of Achoo. McGonagall, you can serve as the head of House Achoo. You better hurry up on making arrangements for Achoo's curriculum and classes. Tomorrow is the first day.
But, stammered
McGonagall, her mind in nearly complete disarray.
Who will be the head of House Gryffindor?
It was all she could think of. She had to stop this somehow. Dumbledore put a finger to his cheek, looking thoughtful. Snape. Snape's screech of protest nearly drowned out McGonagall's.
Then who will be head of Slytherin?
Hagrid.